This episode is sponsored by The Bridge to Recovery, a nonprofit program on 115 acres near Bowling Green, Kentucky, a tranquil place where they've been changing lives for over 40 years. Their people improve their quality of life by acknowledging past emotional wounds and healing from all forms of trauma. The CEO, Paul Hamlin, has been a friend of mine for 20 years. Call him directly at 858-945-7848. That's 858-945-7848. Or you can learn more about The Bridge to Recovery by clicking the link in the show notes or visiting thebridgetorecovery.com. Thank you for listening to The Path to Authenticity. My name's Tom Gentry. I think of this show as the opposite of small talk. You'll hear real conversations with real people who know who they are. We talk about what makes them who they are, how they became who they are, and how we might become truer expressions of who we are.
I'm Taylor Krausor, and this is The Path to Authenticity.
I'm Tom Gentry. Thanks for listening to The Path to Authenticity. This is episode 53 with Taylor Krausor. Taylor's a actor, comedian, writer living in New York City. Today is Saturday, March 28th, 2020. Couple weeks into life kind of coming to a screeching halt in the U.S. over the COVID-19 pandemic. Just crossed 100,000 confirmed cases in the United States in the last 24 hours. I was looking through the calendar not long ago and just kind of mapping out these next several episodes, coming up on a year of episodes. The first one came out on May 1st of 2019. So just looking at the calendar, I noticed May 4th was on a Monday, and I have a new episode coming out every Monday. And it made me think about Taylor, who has a show, an off-Broadway show called A Musical About Star Wars, which he has co-written, co-produced, starred in. And he talks about that in this episode, but I thought it would be cool to do an episode that comes out on May 4th about the musical. And it reminded me that we're going to do another episode specifically about the musical and engage some of the other people involved. But it just reminded me that I've kind of had in the back of my mind, I wanted to have Taylor on the show. And, you know, this is the first family member I'll have had on the podcast. I've had a lot of friends, colleagues, but Taylor's the first family member. He is my great nephew. So, you know, I reached out to him about doing this May 4th thing, and we just got to talking, and I got really excited about doing this, and it made me wonder, you know, why didn't I do this a long time ago? Because I'll tell you this. As soon as we started talking, I knew it was going to be fun. I knew it was going to be a lot of laughs. And this has been as much fun as any episode that I've done. And so we had a long conversation about what led him to become an actor and moving to New York and some of the highlights of his career so far. And there's going to be links in the show notes to some videos of his that where you can learn more about him. He has a short film that took him to the Cannes Film Festival several years back, which he talks about. That's called Sheet Wow, and there's a link to that in the show notes, that video. But we had a great conversation, and I hope you enjoy it every bit as much as I did. I really appreciate him doing this with me, and I hope to have him on again, definitely, and want to support him in whatever future projects he has. So here you go, Taylor Krausor. Taylor, how you doing?
I'm all right. It's weird times.
It is weird times. You know, I always ask the guests, you know, what's a typical day in the life of Taylor Krausor look like? But I'm interested what it's like right now, because I'm sure it's nothing like it normally is.
Yes and no. I will say this kind of made me depressed the other day, because we're now social distancing and quarantining and things like that. But given what I do as a performer, I'm between jobs. You know, like if I'm in a contract for a show for 3 to 5 months, maybe my next doesn't start for another month or two. And so I was currently, before all this started happening in the US, this coronavirus, I was between jobs and I was at home. I mean, I'd go out on auditions, but I was doing a lot of nothing. I was doing a lot of social distancing myself already. And so I kind of got a little like discouraged when we were staying home and everything, and I'd already gotten all my groceries. And I was like, well, I was already social distancing before we were supposed to. Like, what does that say about me right now? I was like, do I not have a life? Like, what's going on?
Of course.
But typically, I mean, for me, I work nights. Typically, when I'm working. So, and I've always been a night person. So for me, I probably don't wake up until honestly like 11 or noon. And then I make a breakfast, small little breakfast, a coffee, and I do some sort of exercise. And then I kind of go from there typically with my day, whether I'm working on something or if I have, you know, work later in the night. Right now, though, for my own mental clarity, there really isn't a wake up time, bedtime. It's just when I'm tired and when I need to get up. And right now, I typically try and stick to that. So I try right now during all this, like we're staying in, and I get up. Obviously, I don't go to a gym, but I've got a pull up bar and I've got some bands, and I wake up and have my coffee and I do some exercises, and then, and I'm trying to right now stay creatively engaged. And I think that's an important thing to try and do right now, and whatever it is for anybody. So like right now, you know, I brought my guitar with me because I was in New York. We'll talk about that in a minute. But I try and set aside at least a little bit of time to like, you know, fiddle on the guitar or draw or, you know, play video games, whatever, something that is like an escape for me, but also is creatively stimulating. Because I think without structure, sometimes we can, I think a lot of people are feeling that, you know, like not just staying in, but feeling, you know, how do I,
yeah, what
it's
do
important
I do?
To keep your how, brain juices how am I gonna going, be me? You know? Yeah. Cause also it's like, you can sit there and be like, well, I have nothing to do. And I could sit there and I could play a video game all day, or I could binge watch, you know, Netflix all day. But after a while of that, like, I feel exhausted in a different way, you know, just being in front of a screen kind of thing. Yeah. So actually a very cool thing. I've been thinking about it for a while, and God knows how long, you know, most of us are out of work and we're having to stay isolated. So I got on my computer and I was searching and I found it all, but, ever since I was a kid, I always wanted to do animation, and I've always liked drawing. My dad's always been good at drawing. And I've been fiddling with the idea, but I actually, before you called, I started looking up different online classes or tutorial sessions of doing 2D animation on your computer. And so that excites me. That's something I've always wanted to do. I'm in this place where I have this weird free time now. Mm-hmm. So I like signed up for these like courses or whatever, and I started learning how to use, you know, Adobe Animator and some cool stuff. So like, I don't know, I'm trying to, you know, do something new.
Yeah.
Keep myself engaged, not try and worry so much, you know?
Man, knowing you some and having had the opportunity to hear songs you've composed and your sense of humor, the idea of you doing an animated series. Oh my God.
Well, the thing about that, which is really cool, is, I think what's great about animation is like the sky's the limit. Like sometimes like when I think of a, like an idea, like where I want to write a short film, you know, like my SheetWow thing, or if I even do a short little video on Instagram or something like that. Sometimes I stop myself from doing it sometimes because I don't have the resources or I don't have the locations or, you know, things like that. Mm-hmm. That's hard to get to. But with animation, I really do feel like the sky's the limit and you can have them do whatever. I've always felt that way. That's why, you know, I mean, I grew up on The Simpsons. That was like what we watched during, like we never ate at a table. We always ate on the couch with like TV trays. And 6 o'clock Fox was 2 hours or an hour of The Simpsons. And that's what I watched while I ate dinner every night growing up. So I've always loved cartoons and funny cartoons. And like, I think Seth MacFarlane has done a wonderful thing with, you know, Family Guy and American Dad and what he's done with animation and how he can kind of, he's changed it too in this way where, he's created that whole cutscene bit where they can literally do, he can make a joke and do anything where Peter Griffin's like, oh yeah, like that one time I was a car, blah, blah, blah. And then like, you know, he's doing whatever and he's in some car lot acting like a car doing whatever joke, you know?
Right.
So it's like the sky's the limit. And so that kind of excites me to really start to figure it out and put some time into it and, you know, be creative and do something new too. I think that's such an important thing is like, it's so easy to get stuck doing the same things or even like things that we know we're good at and opposed to trying something new and scary. Like it's weird. It's kind of weird too what we grow out of. Like I'm a good artist. I always was a good artist. I like drawing. I could not tell you the last time I actually picked up a pencil and drew.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and sometimes I feel like we let those little things that do give us pleasure kind of go to the wayside. And I think that can also sometimes cause us to like feel creatively blocked or whatnot. We get so hung up on, oh, I used to draw and I used to be so good at it. And, man, I don't know if I could do it anymore. It's like, man, it takes some time or this or that. And you're already like creating these hurdles for yourself before you even attempted. Mm-hmm. And half of it is, and what I've learned doing what I do, and I think it applies to anyone's profession, any path of life you're in, but the only way you can truly learn is by failing. Right. And I learned that by, I can give you a million stories in the next 5 minutes of auditions that have gone terrible or, you know, things like that. But you have to learn from it in order to get better. So, you know, I think those are things that we can try and personally work on right now. With this weird time that we don't know what's going on, you know, why not try something new, even just to distract yourself?
Yeah.
Because, you know, it's a lot. It's a lot for our brains to, even just have to sit and comprehend.
Yeah.
What's
happening. It's an overwhelming experience for sure.
Yeah. Yeah.
And for me, you know, writing some and doing this podcast, and I've always, you know, visually, I drew when I was little, but I've always occasionally toyed around with collage.
Oh, that's cool.
But you know, it's not something, I wouldn't call myself a collage artist by any means.
Sure.
I've never tried to do anything that I would try to sell. And I mean, I have a couple things hanging around my place. It's for me, but I mean, even when I was a little kid, I would cover one entire wall in my bedroom and then another wall and, you know, just one big collage.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's like it one discipline feeds the others for me. It's not about what I'm doing with the creativity. It's that I'm nurturing the creativity.
Yeah.
So I'm sure it's that way for you too. But you know, you mentioned the sheet wow thing. I definitely want to talk about that.
Oh yeah.
Cause that obviously was a big milestone in your career, evolution, or however you describe it. But, how'd you become this person? Like, how did this all start?
Well, several things. My mom and dad got together in high school and you know, that happened. So both my parents had me very young. And at a young age, I didn't have like the conventional family, and it's a weird thing even saying that, like, that's something I always aspired to want as a kid. Like just, you know, parents that are together and like, you know, middle America, you know, house, yard, dog kind of thing. Like that's what all my friends had. But then looking back on it, it's so funny. I wouldn't have had it any other way. I wouldn't be who I am without all the experiences I had. Mm-hmm. But I think it kind of starts back to, and this is, I had this realization a couple years ago watching old family videos at my grandparents up in Northern Indiana. But it was when my mom and I were living at her parents' house when I was about one or two. And there's these videos, my grandma would just dress me up. As like, she would put like a pillow in my stomach, and all of a sudden I would start acting like, just with a pillow, I would just start acting like some like fat guy being like, I ate too much. Oh, and then immediately would turn that into, oh no, I'm having a baby. And like, and it was kind of amazing that I was watching my mom and my grandma fuel this creativity happening with this like 3-year-old kid. And nurturing me in that way of like, then they would hand me a hat or they would hand me another, but like, and I just started doing these things. I truly believe after watching that video, that's where it all started for me, because then from there on out, it was like, if you look at pictures of it, I was always dressing up. I was always creating weird little characters, you know, things like that. That was like my favorite thing to do whenever we had company over, is I'd go in my room and I'd find whatever weird clothing I could find and put it all together and come out and be some weird character and start trying to entertain people, you know? Awesome. And my mom really supported that. And like, kudos to her for that, because, you know, it was, we grew up, I mean, obviously we were in Kokomo, you know, where you're from too. But my mom at, you know, 18 was like, I don't want to raise my son up in Northern Indiana. And she wanted to get an education. So she busted her ass for 3 or 4 years working crazy jobs, and moved us down to Bloomington, Indiana. And she went to IU, and she kind of just led by example. It's funny. I mean, I think about like, if I didn't have a babysitter, I would sit in the back of, you know, her art history class while I'm playing my Game Boy, you know, things like that. It was like, I had to have a lot of independence at a young age. We had to trust each other. We kind of grew up together. And she fueled this creativity. She always, like, if there was something I wanted to try or something I wanted to do, she would, within her abilities, be able to do that. Now, I think about now, I'm 29 years old, and if I had an 11-year-old, you know, that sounds crazy to me.
Yeah.
But she did it. And looking back, I never once thought, you know, when I was a kid, when I was young, that I didn't think things were bad. That was our life, and it was good. I didn't know we were on food stamps. I didn't know things were hard. I didn't know she was jumping from job to job. Well, so whatever her poker face was with me was amazing. And it's really helped me. It allowed me to feel this creativity that I use as a profession. But B, it's helped me to just get through any hardship I've been through. Like when I first moved to New York after college, that was the first time I left Indiana. Cause I stayed here. I went to Indiana University for theater. A lot of my other friends had gone to other schools, you know, but, and I decided to move to New York City. That was in 2013. And that's a big jump when you've only been in one state your whole life.
Especially when it's like Indiana, you know?
Yeah. You know? And I found myself to be a very capable person, but I'll never forget there was when I first moved out there, before I even auditioned for shows or anything like that, I was like, I gotta get a job, just a job to pay my bills. I'm gonna figure all that out first. Like, that is my first priority. If I need to figure out how I'm living here, I already had an apartment with some friends. And I was going from, I was doing some like catering gigs. I did some crazy ones, but that was just wearing on me. And I wanted to find something more consistent because I was hopping around so much, at least work with the same people and at least build, you know, a friendship or a relationship. So, and I kept going in for these like different job interviews, like server jobs and like not good jobs, but like, you know, something to get by. And I was getting turned down constantly just for even serving jobs and stuff like that. And there was one morning, and I was like done. I remember laying there being like, I'm not doing it. Like, I'm not going to this interview today. Like, I had one more interview and I was like, this fucking sucks. Like, I don't want to do this. And then I laid there and I thought about it for a minute, and literally the image of, you know, what if you had an 8-year-old kid right now? I thought of my mom. Like, I thought about everything she did with a kid. I was like, if you can't go there today, and that's the one thing you have to do today, and it's just you and you're not providing for anyone else, you can go do that, dude. If she could do that with the kid, you can go do it. And that, lo and behold, became the restaurant job I got, and that I have consistently had that job when I've needed money for the last 8 years. So like, that's been a great gift. And it was kind of cool that it took that reminder of, you know, her, getting me through it. So like, in that way, that's shaped me a lot of just my perseverance too. Mm-hmm. With being a performer, you can't stop, even if someone is like telling you, you suck, you should stop. You know, it's like, because people will eventually do other careers. They will eventually fall aside. But if you stick with it, you know, there's a chance.
There's not a chance if you quit.
No, because you're done. Then you know you've made your choice, you know. So long story short, and dude, your episode's going to be like 3 hours long because I will not stop talking that shit forever.
We can split it into a couple episodes. This is great.
Whatever you want to do.
Let's keep going, man.
I'm a talker. But no, so I think that was the start. If we're talking about my path to my authentic self, it definitely started there, you know, as not even knowing as a kid, but like, you know, just her leading as an example. And also, you know, I grew up in the Midwest too, and wanting to perform and do theater. Not everyone supports that.
Right.
And a perfect example is one of my best friends. He lives in LA now, and he's done a lot of commercial acting and stuff like that. And he grew up in Evansville, Indiana. So as like almost as southern as you can get in the state. And he was like an all-star like football player. He was the quarterback when he was a freshman for the varsity team, all those things. And like, you know, they breathe football there. He quit football his senior year because it conflicted with the school play, and he wanted to do that. He knew that he wanted to pursue performing. And the whole town like hated him for it. And like, still to this day, like when he's gone back home, like, it's not like everyone's like, screw you, Russell, whatever. But like, they have, it was like a black mark on his name.
Yeah.
Because why would you do that? And I think he could have played in college, but you know, he wanted to pursue, this is what he wanted to do. And he did not have, and he still did it, but he did not have the support. Now, my mom did an amazing thing by moving me to one of the most, probably like, I would say most liberal areas in the state of Indiana.
Yeah,
in Bloomington, with the college being here. And so by doing that, I kind of weirdly had, before the show Glee came out, I was on the football team and doing the musicals. And I had a football coach who would be like, God damn it, Krausor, do I have to fucking sing and dance these motherfucking plays to you? And he'd like yell in your face, but guess who would be the first one standing and applauding at my musical?
Right.
Coach Dean. You know what I mean? So like, I had this weird experience of just this unconditional support. And not everyone has that, you know. Yeah. I'll never forget, he pulled me aside one time, and he was like Napoleon syndrome kind of guy. Like, I mean, you picture like short, like balding. He's probably like 5'2", always has like sunflower seeds he's chewing. It's like he never spit them out. Like, I don't know if he swallowed them, but he's always chewing them. And when he gets angry, I mean, his face is like beet red and he's all up in your face. And one time he's chewing me out about something. I can't remember. He pulls me out of the game. I had like a pass interference call. And he's just pacing. And the pit of your stomach is just like hurting because you don't know what he's going to say to you and whatnot. He's been chewing me out. I'm sitting on the bench. And finally he goes, get over here. He's like, you know, I fucking love you, right? And I was like, what? Yes? No? Like, I don't know. Like, he just like eviscerated me, but like, right. But he supported me, you know? So, but it's having that support at an early age too. And then, and my dad is the same for that. It's like, anytime I would, you know, write a silly song when I was a kid or perform something, like he was like almost like my biggest fan. He would be like I did this thing in middle school. I basically turned it was called KNN, Kids News Network. And it was just to do the morning announcements, on Wednesdays as a visual medium for like the mass media class. And every Wednesday morning in homeroom, all your TVs would come on and be like, hi, I'm Brian. And this is this week's news for Jackson Creek Middle School. Like, you know, just really bad, whatever. Right. But I saw that as an opportunity when I was an eighth grader. I was like, dude, we could do this and it could be super fun. And the mass media teacher had just quit and we got a brand new guy who had no clue what he was doing. And so it just became me and my friends taking over this little tiny studio. And we basically made it like our own mini Saturday Night Live. Like, we were doing characters and we were writing crazy stuff. And I took it, and that's still like we put all that on a VHS. And I would take that, and I remember taking it up to my dad's one weekend, and I've never seen someone be more proud, more beaming. He took that tape everywhere we went. Anytime we would visit family, anywhere we would go, he's like, you guys got to watch this, man. And he would pop in that video and he would show my sketches to family and friends. And that kind of support is also so important because, you know, it allows you to have the confidence. You know, it's not like one of those things of like you tell your kid, like maybe they're not good at something, but you're like, yeah, it's pretty good. Yeah. I mean, it was like, there was honesty in it too. Yeah. Like, I feel like my parents would have, if it was something fun I wanted to do, they would absolutely always be like, yes, pursue this. But I would also kind of want to know, like, if, you know, if I thought that this was a pipe dream to everybody, like, if it ain't in the cards, like, I might want to know that earlier on in some degree, but no, my dad was always just like a huge fan, and that was just like that kind of support was awesome.
Still does that, right? You know that, right?
Oh, totally. Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
And you really have. You've been nurtured, and it's awesome.
Totally.
Yeah.
But it's funny though too, because it's like this quote that I hold on to all the time. No one can stop you but yourself. No one can stop you but yourself. And that's actually something I talk about. And this is an important thing in being authentic and figuring out who you are. Is as like successful as I have been with certain things, there's been a lot of struggle too. And it's been like self struggle, you know, and it's important to be able to know like how to get yourself out of that, because there have been many times too where it's not deliberate self-sabotage, but you can get in your head and you can totally kind of like derail yourself from the path a little bit, and be confused as to why that is or what's happening. But it's something I have to constantly remind myself too, is to, you know, keep that like my dad's voice in my head, in a sense, right. You know, just like that championing you to do that.
And you know,
it's super easy.
Like,
yeah.
As we get older, for me, what I've had to learn how to do is to choose which voices I wanted, you know, like I don't go to everybody with everything. I mean, I go to the people
huge.
Who I know are going to be in my corner.
That's huge, because that's the biggest, we can talk about that for a minute, because I would be so bad about making a decision that I would spread the question so thin between so many different voices and opinions, where then it didn't even matter what anyone said. I was just confused. about the advice I was getting, because I was getting advice from anybody and everybody, and I kept asking the question, and now I'm just stressed out because now I have no answer at all.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's an important thing of what you just said, is there should be like two or three people that are just like your close go-tos. Like my partner, Jamie, she's the one I go to constantly for everything. And I know it can sometimes be draining on her because I can be a lot with stuff like that, but she's always been upfront and honest with me about everything. And that is so important to me. And sometimes you need to hear things you don't typically want to hear.
Yeah.
And for me, like the perfect example of that with her, I try every joke out on her, and sometimes I feel like I shouldn't have, because she doesn't always, like, I have two joke people. I test it out on her, and I test it out on my friend Russell. My friend Russell and I, like, we are like always on the same wavelength, like kind of finish each other's sentences kind of thing. So, you know, we get each other's humor, but also I want an outside perspective. Jamie and I have similar humor tastes, but you know, she's not always like writing jokes or doing this and that. But she will be brutally honest with me when things are not funny. And sometimes you need that. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's not someone sitting there saying you suck. It's constructive criticism to help you. Like, she loves me unconditionally. So if she gives me a criticism, that's something I still have to work on to this day, Tom. It's like, and I think anybody can tell you that, it's like, you not taking these things personally. Mm-hmm. Jamie's not saying anything because she wants to hurt me, or she thinks I suck or I'm bad. You know, it's, she wants me to be the best I can be.
Mm-hmm.
And so if this joke isn't landing, like, yeah, don't go do that on stage because it's not funny and you can do better. And you know, it's not that I suck, I should stop doing it. And that's such a hard thing, especially as a performer, because you are the merchandise. Like, you are constantly putting yourself out there. And so it can kind of mess with your head. So that's why I feel like that's important. And that's a struggle I still have to this day, is, you know, not taking things personally.
Hmm.
And that's something, but you know,
that's just the human condition. And,
oh, totally.
Or, you know, I mean, we all go through that, but, so something that's timely. Sheetwow.
Yeah.
Tell the listeners.
Oh, is it timely? It's so timely. Oh my God. As soon as people started freaking out about toilet paper. So there was this thing when I was in college, called Campus Movie Fest, and it's the largest college film festival in the United States. And their whole premise every year for their program is that anyone can make a movie. So you have a week to make a 5-minute short, and you get judged on best picture, best comedy, best drama, all these different things. And when I've always been drawn to TV medium and film medium. And even though I've done a lot of stage stuff and was in school for musical theater and everything like that. And so a friend of mine, I was in a show that spring, and that film fest was coming up, and I was like, hey man, like, they give us the equipment, like, they give you a MacBook and a camera, like, you want to make something? He's like, sure. Now, I knew we weren't as good as half the other kids that were in the film school, who would like edit things and color correct and do sound and audio, and that's what they were being judged on too, you know. So I was like, well, we're funny. We have that, and also I want to play into the medium of what we have. So the first year I did it for Sheetwow, this is what prompted Sheetwow, I created a video. I don't know if you've ever seen this one, but it was called Project Birdsong. And the idea was about my friend Matt being in college. And it was a shaky cam mockumentary, 5 minutes of me with the premise of, I think my roommate's a superhero. I found some footage, watch. And it's just ridiculous of where me and all my friends were these archetype characters of, like, Matt was the superhero. Our friend Kurt was the sidekick, but was also kind of my sidekick, being like my roadie, helping me out with the camera thing. We had our friend Andrew was the villain. Girl Chloe was like damsel in distress, but it all took place in real life. It was very ridiculous. It was really fun and stupid. And we improvised the whole thing and shot it in a week and storyboarded it, put it together. We got top 16 that year. We didn't get any awards or anything, but we got top 16 at our school. Like, that's pretty cool. So the next year, I wanted to do it again. But I had a friend in the film school, my friend Ben, and I said, listen, I have a really funny idea, and you shoot things beautifully. I think we can win this whole damn thing. And so we got together, and the original idea was, it was going to be like someone was watching TV and flipping through the stations, and it was going to be a bunch of commercials and TV shows, so it could be like a variety show in 5 minutes. But the first sketch I started writing was, I wanted to make an infomercial, and I wanted to be like a Billy Mays, like, hey, have you seen this? It's amazing. And I'm going to yell at you. Why? You know, like that kind of thing. I'm just like, Jesus Christ. Like, you're like jumping through the TV to sell me this shit. And I was trying to think of a product. And I remember sitting in the library, and I was supposed to be writing a paper, but I'm thinking about this thing. And I was like, God, what's something like what's, you know, like, contradictory. Like, it's always funny. Like, what's one thing that contradicts the other? And I was like thinking of things and thinking of products. And then it hit me, and I was like, reusable toilet paper. That's fucking disgusting. And then I was like, oh wait, that's funny. And like sitting there in the library, I went like kind of under my breath, the SheWow, the reusable toilet paper you can use again and again repeatedly. And I started laughing, and I was like, that's hilarious. So I start writing that out. And then once I kept writing it, I realized, oh, this needs to be the whole short. We're not doing the whole like mini TV right. flipping through the channels thing anymore. This is it. This is very funny. So you can do all the writing before the week of filming, but you have that week to film it, edit it, put it together. And this was the first example in my life of collaborating and what the beauty of collaboration is. Where, you know, opposed to being like, I was the kid in middle school who was like, oh my God, I have Ben and Sam and Bridget and my group, and they suck. And you know what, guys, I'll do the poster. I'll take it home. I got it. Don't worry about it. Like, right. I was that kid. So for me to delegate was kind of hard sometimes. But I really trusted my friend Ben who filmed this and directed with me. And he had his roommate, Marshall, was in the music school. And can just sit there and compose and write music on the fly. And we just had all these great resources to where it was the first time that I was able to like let go and trust in someone else. And we made something beautiful. Like I could not have shot and color corrected and made that sketch look the way it looked, which is important to it, to, you know, the authenticity of it and it being this polished product. Even though it's about shit, you know, like it's this, you know, infomercial about, it's like the ShamWow, but it's a poop rag that the joke is they keep using it on everything and there's just shit smearing everywhere. And it's so and gross.
There will be a link in juvenile. The show notes for listeners to watch it. Yeah.
But also the important lesson is we just had fun. Like we were just so in it and having fun, and I remember I failed a final and I was okay with it because I either had to sit and edit this thing or I had to study for this final I had. And in that moment, it's my senior year of college, I was like, this class, I'll pass it. This is more important to me. You know, and so we have to figure that out in life sometimes. You get things, you know, your plate can be full and you got to figure out what's important to me. I'm glad I made that choice because we won at IU. We won best actor, best director, best sound because our friend had composed all the music, and best comedy. So when you win best comedy, best picture, best drama, it moves to California to compete nationally. So then that summer after I graduated from college, I was working at a theater in Colorado doing shows, so I couldn't go. But I get a phone call from Ben and he was in LA and he's like, we won best comedy nationally, dude. And I was like, that's crazy. And so it was just this really beautiful example of collaboration and trusting in other people and what you can create when you collaborate. You know, that's just this huge example I learned from that. And then now flash forward a year, I've been in New York now for, you know, 6 months or so. I moved there in the fall 2013 and it's now spring of 2014. And I kept getting these emails like Cannes Film Festival, Cannes, whatever. But you get so many emails, whether it's like Casper Mattresses or, you know, like GNC wants to sell you this. And I'm always swiping and deleting, always swiping and deleting. And I kept getting these and I was like, what the hell is this, dude? I would swipe and delete emails from Cannes Film Festival. I was just deleting them. And then my friend Ben kept texting me, and he's like, dude, did you see about the movie? Did you see about the movie? And I was like, what are you talking about? And he's like, we got selected to go to the Cannes Film Festival. And I was like, what? So then I go back and I'm opening my like trash file. And I was like, holy shit. Oh, we're going to the Cannes Film Festival. Like, that's crazy. And so it was a lot of money though. My mom was amazing. And again, going back to having an amazing support system, she started like a quick GoFundMe thing. Because, you know, I was a young struggling actor in New York City to help with, just paying for my flight and stuff to go to France. And she raised like $2,000 just from people she knew who believed in me. And that was really cool. Yeah. Like that alone was like a very cool, like that's an amazing gift, just to have that support. And, so Ben and I went to the Cannes Film Festival, and we weren't like on the big screen, like, and like where they do the red carpets, like where there was like a Tommy Lee Jones film that we went to and stuff like that. But we were screened in the short film corner of the main pavilion, and we went and we watched our short. And I learned too, like that festival was more about like the buying and selling of films. So it was an amazing experience to be in France. I'd never been overseas. But we had, you know, little like cards of our film, and we're passing them out, and we're trying our best to, you know, like hustle,
right?
And be out there. Like, we were invited one night. This was crazy. We were invited one night to a party, because that's all you do is you get up early, you go see films all day, and then people just party all night long. And I'm not a big partier myself, but I would like stay out and go to these crazy places. And one night we were in someone's home up in like the hills, overlooking the whole like island area, and you see the beach and the water, and there's a big pool. It's a beautiful place. It's all these fancy people there. And also, now I'll never forget, at one point they're like, excuse me, everyone, please direct your attention to the pool for your entertainment. And some ballerina just walks out and just starts performing. And this cellist comes out and starts playing, and she's just doing her thing around this pool. And we're all watching. I'm like, where the hell am I? Like, this is crazy. Right. So it was a cool experience. And that was a very cool thing to do. And to this day, you know, it's like, that's been the biggest lesson to me of, you know, what can come from collaboration and believing in something and also having a passion for it too. You know, it was like,
well, was, you know, cool. And it's an amazing story. Just the fact that
totally
out of college, right out of the gate.
Yeah.
You're going to Cannes.
Yeah. It was very cool. And then right after that, I got my first, right during that, I was when I got my first big acting job in New York. I was the swing, which means you cover all the parts when someone gets sick, but for this show called Forbidden Broadway, which has been around, they do different editions constantly, but it's a show that mixes or makes fun of what's currently on Broadway. So it was kind of this weird mix of, you know, I've loved comedy. I grew up watching Saturday Night Live and Seinfeld and all these things. And I've always wanted to do comedy, but I went to school. The only way I could get on stage was to do the musicals in high school. And so then that led to me doing that in college. And so here I was doing this musical theater thing and learning to like sing and dance and stuff like that. But I've always had this passion for comedy and doing impressions, and Forbidden Broadway literally like blended the worlds together, where, you know, you're up there and you're doing like a Patti LuPone impression or like Mandy Patinkin, you know, you're doing what these current seasons, and you're lampooning them. And I learned a lot in that those 6 months I was at that job, you know, and my first professional job. And a lot of people know Forbidden Broadway. And the crazy thing about that was I auditioned for it, and within a week I heard back that I got it, and I started in 2 weeks, a week and a half, something like that. And I had to go on in 2 weeks. And the first day at the job, and there's a lot of material, and there's two guys I cover in the show. It's two guys and two girls. And they were like, yeah, Scott's out next week, so you'll be on for Scott's track. So just learn Scott's track of the show. And so I'm like stressed out, because it's my first job, you know, like real, real job. And it's in the city. And I'm a hard worker, and I'm learning this stuff like every single day and busting ass. And I remember asking the female swing at the show, I was like, so what happened to the other guy? Like, did he quit? Or she's like, oh no, they just hired you. Like, there wasn't another guy. I was like, why was I hired so late? Like, that's crazy. So, you know, it really taught me that, like, I can, like, and I can learn and memorize anything because of that job in like a heartbeat now, because I had to, that was my job. I had to learn it, and I had to go on, and I had to perform it for an audience in a week with like hardly any rehearsal. And then the day after I finished going on for Scott, and I did well, I might've had a few little mistakes here and there, but I did the show. It was great. It was fun. My family was actually in town. I got to see it. And then the next day though, they were like, Marcus is sick. Can you go on for Marcus? And I was like, absolutely not. Cause you guys told me to do that for Scott all week. And I didn't have time to learn it. So they had to bring in another guy who did the road show, and I knew a little bit of Marcus's. So we did like a weird 5-person show, but it's kind of what you do in theater sometimes, and which is crazy and fun. And so I learned a lot from that too. So it's a lot of things happened right out of the gate that taught me a lot of good lessons of what I'm capable of, you know. And when you push yourself, like what you can actually do, opposed to sitting around thinking about it forever, just once you start to put something into practice, you can really show yourself like, oh, I can do this. Yeah. You know?
Yeah.
It might seem impossible. Like the task at the time, it seemed crazy. If you told me in a week you have to go on and do this entire show and you have 2 rehearsals with us and everything else on your own, like that sounds crazy. That sounds super stressful. But when you're under the gun and you have a deadline, you know, you do it. Mm-hmm. And I did it. And I did what like felt like the impossible. And so that's why it's a, I don't know, I think it's a cool thing to kind of reflect and think back on.
Absolutely. You proved to yourself that you could do it. So yeah. Tell me about some of the other, what are some of the favorite roles that you've played over the years?
I've played over the years. I did regionally. I mean, cause I love, as much as I love doing comedy and I like and doing stand up and stuff like that, I still just love doing musicals. There's just something really fun about the medium, and the expression of, you know, your thoughts and feelings through music is very cool. But for me, one that I loved to do, I did it in Boston at North Shore Music Theater a couple of years back, but I got to play Gaston in Beauty and the Beast. And that's fun. Like that's a fun role because, you know, you are kind of the comic relief. And this was right after the election. This was in 2017. And so something we kind of talked about was just like, you know, the Me Too movement is starting and it's like, you know, what does this guy represent? This character who's this misogynistic, huge, masculine, toxic kind of person. He's so self-absorbed and, you know, kind of like our new president. You know, we talked about that. Like not making the show, it's a Disney show. We're not making it political, but just like think about that, you know?
Yeah.
And so there is this line of like he is a cartoon character and I got all the laughs and I had so much fun doing that in the beginning. But by the end of the show, it's that reverse, you know, what happens at the end of the show is him and the actual Beast are fighting and the Beast doesn't want to hurt him. And he loves Belle, all of that stuff, you know, and you see the real Beast come out, which is Gaston, and he's trying to kill him and stab him. And that's fun to play. Like I would play, like I love doing comic stuff, but like playing the villain in something is so much fun to a kind of go there. I'm such a nice goofy person in life. Like that we all have our dark side, but it's fun to tap into that and explore that, and kind of go there. So that was a cool role because you kind of got to do both. You got to get some laughs in the first act and be silly. And I think a lot of people said like, I kind of gave them like a Steve Martin vibe. I don't know if I was like moving my hips a lot when I did it. I don't know what it was, but like, I think he's like my idol. So I'm like, that's great. But it's cool that then at the end I could come in and like, you know, really not like scare people, but like, you know, bring the intensity that the show needs for the villain.
Right.
So that's a cool one. I enjoyed that a lot. I'm trying to think of another one that, like that I've really, because a lot of my work, because I've also done like a lot of like cabaret work and stuff like that, of just, you know, knowing people in the industry and I've done some fun shows like that. But I did Musical to Musical I did that show on and off for about 4 or 5 years. And that was an off-Broadway sketch show very much like for how Forbidden Broadway was, but it was, that was truly like Saturday Night Live meets musical theater. Like that one was where we would have sketches and songs about current events. So the show was always changing too. So that was very fun. Some of my nearest and dearest friends are from that, you know, that's how we created the Star Wars show, which we can talk about. It kind of came from that too. Right. But that one was fun, was because that's what doing musical really got me doing stand up. Because you had to do all these impressions for that, that weren't just, here's musical theater impressions that only musical performers are going to know. It was like, you have come in with like an Al Gore and a George Bush and a Matthew McConaughey and, you know, like these things you would see on Saturday Night Live. So it's cool. You come in there, you're like, hey, how's it going? I'm Matthew McConaughey and we're going to talk about the news or whatever, you know, like, it was fun to get to play with that and learn new ones. Like if a new story would come out and they'd be like, hey, do you do Aziz Ansari? And I was like, no, but I can try. I guess I can try. I don't know. Maybe I should try, you know? And so it was because it was that pressure again of like, here's a deadline. You got to go do it. Like I knew in a week we were writing a new sketch about someone or something. Like you better learn that impression so you don't look like an asshole. You know what I mean? Right, like that's right. Like for me, we do Obama in the show, and some nights, like that was a show where sometimes if someone was sick, like we were really good because we knew all the material, we could jump around and help someone else out. Like my friend Michael was sick, I was good at his impressions that he did too, so I could fill in for him. And he always usually did Obama, but for me, I was like, oh my god, I don't want to do a bad Obama impression, so I really worked on that. After a while, you just well, Tom, you figure it out. And that's what we got to do, is we got to just go forward from here. Because when they go low, Tom, we go high. So, you know, it's like, it's figuring out those things. Like, and I learned from that, it wasn't just about the voice, but it's about like, it's timing. About the mannerisms. It's about the timing. It's about like, what is it about this person's voice that's intriguing? And it's like, oh, well, I learned early on. I'm like, oh, what's funny about, you know, Barack Obama is, he's just kind of trailing off. And I think whether you sound exactly like someone, if you can find a mannerism or two and then amplify it, that's your take on it. Like yeah. Dana Carvey is like the king of that. Like yeah. Dana Carvey's George Walker Bush doesn't really sound like him, but he did this thing where he just exaggerated what he was doing and that, and it kept on Dan. And it's funny. Right. And now here's a take on it. So I think that's a fun way to go about it, you know, of like, you know, what's your take on it? Like what I've developed over with Trump for the years. And I talked with you about this before we started, like I got very tired of doing Trump because it was so constant all the time. But my whole thing was I didn't even realize I was doing it because I was performing as him on stage so much, but I was starting to make him like more and more like effeminate, almost like a cartoon character, almost like a Looney Tune thing. Like, because at first he was here, he was always here. But then after a while, I kept doing it and I kind of go here. And then I would do this and I would talk about this. And then like, it just kind of became, he is such an ass and such a cartoon. Like, I really did start making him a full cartoon character. Like, facial expressions was like, I really just exaggerated the mouth thing. Even if my face doesn't look like him, I exaggerated that, like the hand movements and making sharp, quick, and the finger pointing and always having like a few key things to say. Like one of my favorite things to say, I would come out because depending on the audience, we got a lot of tourists at that show. So there'd be some nights we would have all 100 seats full. And there'd be some nights, Tom, where it would be 12 people. And you still did that show for 12 people. Like they paid for that, you know. And not everyone too also loved news. It's just like, not everyone loves SNL. It's like sometimes we get people that walk out or don't like the show, whatever. So those were the nights where I liked to come out as Trump. And we had a song called, I don't even remember the name of the song. I've actually blocked it out, which is maybe a good thing. But anytime we had a small house, the one that killed every time is I would look at our accompanist Ed on the piano and I'd be like, Ed, look at this audience. What a tremendous audience. Look at you guys. I see like a million and a half, just tremendous. Look at the size of this crowd. I've never had a larger crowd, and this is going to be the largest crowd in the history of Broadway, you know, like I just do stuff like that, or like whatever ridiculous things, or like around the new year, I always like to do a joke, whatever the year was. So like the last year we did the show before it closed, I'd be like, what did I say? It was something about like, because of me, it is now 2020. Okay. That is the highest year in the history of year, you know, like just stupid things that you would do, and mess with the audience or whatnot. And, but the funny thing about talking about him, especially with that show, was we would write a sketch for him. This is like early on, even like, before he became the president. But he would do something so ridiculous that that sketch within 2 weeks, like we're not SNL. We don't timestamp it. That was that week. That was relevant. Now they move on. Like our stuff stays in a little bit, you know. We would write a really funny sketch. Like we had this really funny song between Trump and Putin called If You Say You Love Me. And it was this love ballad between the two of them. And they like kiss at the end. It was hilarious. It was a very funny number. I think the chorus was, if you say you love me, we'll have all the world to gain. And there's all these jokes in between. Like it's stupid and fun. But after 3 weeks of that, he had already done something so ridiculous and crazy. The number wasn't relevant anymore. And then it wasn't funny. And then we're trying to write a new sketch. So eventually our writer, Rick Crome, he's an amazing stand-up comedian. Has been writing material for musical for years. And he finally wrote a universal song for him about his tweets, to where it was the same number about him tweeting. It's called I've Got My Finger on the Button. Buttons, meaning like my phone.
Right.
And so then what the joke would be, I would insert new tweets. I had three sections between the choruses, and I'd be like, so whatever happened to that week or whatnot, I could insert the new joke. So that song always stayed current. We no longer had to scramble and be like, this doesn't work anymore. This guy's already, you know. So, you know, you had to kind of come up with that. But after a while, it was exhausting. It was just like, and I know so many people in comedy felt that way too. Even like with the late night hosts and this and that, it was like, it's funny at first and everyone has a take. And then after a while, like, and it felt good. It felt good to get out there and be like, yeah, like we're sticking it to him and we're making our jokes. We're making our points and it's liberating to go out there and like speak your truth and all this stuff. And then, goddamn, I'm doing this show for like, it's like 5 months in. And I'm like, I was like physically exhausted of just doing him.
Yeah.
Because it was, he's nonstop. And it is so much. And you saw it too, like in the news cycles, even when I would go out to clubs and do stand up, like if people were doing Trump stuff, it had to have like a really specific take on it in some regards. Cause people are just like, even you just start doing the voice, like, oh, here we go. Cause it's, that's how you are on the news.
Yeah.
You're like, oh, here we go. Like so different than someone even pulling out like a George W. impression or doing that. You know what I mean? Like that was, you weren't.
It is exhausting. The whole thing is exhausting. Yeah.
It's a lot, you know? And so that weirdly had a very interesting toll on me. It was the first time I was doing something like that where I was just like, I don't want to do this anymore. Yeah. Meaning the impression, not like acting and performing, but I was like, and I knew we couldn't take him out of the show, but it was this thing of like, I was like, I am just exhausted from even jokingly portraying this man as a caricature.
So I want to talk about the Star Wars show, but before we get to that, you were talking about how you develop these impressions, and I once had the opportunity to hear you do this sort of working impression of old Eddie Murphy, older Eddie Murphy versus younger Eddie Murphy. So can you do a little bit of that?
With him, it was one day I was like, I started laughing, like it was a genuine laugh. Like, I was laughing about something and someone's like, dude, you sound like Eddie Murphy. And so then I kind of started exaggerating the laugh, like just doing that or whatever. But I think I was trying to write a bit about him writing. It was like a commercial for like Viagra, but instead of calling it Viagra, he's like, hi, I'm Eddie Murphy. It means that my dick, big dick pill or something like ridiculous. Yes, it was just like him. Cause he was always so dirty and raunchy. It was something like that. I actually totally forget. That was definitely one I worked on. I think when I tried it too, I don't know if that one went over as well. I might not even scrap it at the time. That's the thing too. It's like, yeah, I'll go out and I'll have an idea. And I'll, like one time, this was funny. I mean, funny now, but so when you go to clubs, and I honestly haven't been going out very often. We can talk about that later. But when I would go out a lot and you go to open mics, you're basically going into the basement of some bar in the Village in New York. And most of these open mics to get feedback, it's just you and other comics. And half the time it sucks because they're not even paying attention. They're just sitting there writing their own little thing. So you're not, it's not like how it used to be in some places where like you might pay a small cover to go to like to an actual bar and do an open mic where there's patrons. Or there might be people who heckle you, but you just get a, you know, a gauge. So sometimes it's really hard to gauge from these little comic open mics. And like I had a mentor tell me like these are just for you to get up and do it on stage. But sometimes it can totally get in your head when you're working on something, even just to work it out, but like no one's fucking laughing.
Yeah.
And you're like, Jesus, is this funny or not? Like, I don't know. But I one time tried to do this thing. It was when the Colin Kaepernick kneeling thing started in the controversy of people getting upset with him taking a knee during the national anthem. And my whole take was something along the lines of, like, I don't know why people think that's so rude and so unpatriotic. You want to know what's rude and unpatriotic is Jim Carrey doing the Pledge of Allegiance. And I tried so hard, Tom, to do this thing like physically as Jim Carrey and trying to do the whole like fast talking, I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America. Like I tried to do that whole thing, but was doing like the crazy Ace Ventura, like humping motions and like right. throwing my body around because that's disrespectful. You know what I mean? And right. that was my whole point. And I still think that's I mean, like you laughed at, like, it's a funny idea.
Oh, absolutely.
But dude, I did that for a small room of like 10 people to fucking nothing, like to like no laughs, no nothing. And that's like the brutal side to it too. But you know, you have to find a place to work those things out and you got to try it, you know? So that's kind of part of all that of, you know, sometimes they work, sometimes they don't. Yeah. That's actually funny. I'm glad you laughed at that one. Maybe I should bring that one back up.
It was fascinating actually to hear you work through something because you were talking about the characteristics in the different versions of Eddie Murphy's voice. You were talking yeah. through it and describing it in his voice. And you must have been like, Dad, check this out. And you sent it to your dad and
yeah.
I get this text like, oh my God, you got to listen to this.
Well, that's it. And again, that's.
And then like I'm playing it at work for to. Guys. And I mean,
it oh, was, that's awesome.
It was great, dude.
That's yeah, awesome. I appreciate that. That's cool.
No, I mean,
yeah,
listen,
that's a thing. It's
not like fake. Like we talked about, like, it's really funny. You're funny. You really are. It's,
yeah.
It's not like you're yeah, someone who's that. Trying to be funny. You're funny. So now Star Wars, let's talk about the show. Tell me about that.
Yeah, definitely. That's been the last year of my life. So I'll backtrack a little bit about how I got to this place of I co-wrote and I'm starring in, you know, this off Broadway show for the last year. So when I was doing musical, I would come and go. They were really good about, you know, we had a small group of people who could do the show and come in and out. So like if I would book something, like I said, I did that Beauty and the Beast show or I did another off-Broadway show or this or that. They were really great about having someone fill in. And like I'd be gone for 6 months and then someone else would leave and come back. And so there was like a few of us on rotation. And I did the show with my friend Scott Foster a lot. I did musical with him a lot. And he's also a huge Star Wars fan. Like my dad just like basically ingrained Star Wars into me at a very young age. And just always play with all of his like Kenner action figures and stuff. And so that when I was gone from musical, Scott was in the show and he had written this really funny Star Wars rap after The Last Jedi came out. And our producer, Tom Dangora, who's a really good friend of mine, at first I was like, I don't know. I don't know if people are going to like it. He's like, Scott was like, everyone loves Star Wars. Just let me just try it and we'll put it in. He's like, okay. So he wrote this thing that him and my friend Michael did, and they were just these two Star Wars nerds doing like a Beastie Boys rap about being a fanboy, and it killed. It killed. We kept it in the show until we finally closed the show. Musical was open for almost 10 years off Broadway, and we closed it last summer. And that Star Wars rap was in there for like the last 2 years. Always got a great laugh. And that gave Tom the idea the year before. He was like to Scott, while I was still gone, hey, that rap was really good. What if we did a whole show like that, where it's based on like your nerdiness for Star Wars and this and that? He's like, that's great. And he's like, I was thinking maybe it'd be like two guys, one girl kind of situation. And we figure out what the show would be like, whether it was like sketches or this or that. He's like, yeah. And they both looked at each other like, we should get Taylor in on this. So they called me up. And at first we didn't really know what we were doing. None of us had really like written a show. Like Tom's been a producer for a very long time and knows, and he was very heavily involved with what we did in Newsical constantly. And so he knew how to like, he's very good at editing for like what gets a laugh, what doesn't get a laugh, you know, things like that. And so we kind of just wrote, it wasn't even a musical. We just kind of started writing these like Star Wars sketches and these weird ideas, but we kept being like, oh, you know, it'd be a funny song, because we all have musical background. Like, it'd be a funny song. And we'd kind of like leave those for blank areas. And then we finally decided after like several months of getting together and writing, like we should write a musical. Like that's what we all do. Like it'd be really funny. And so it kind of just became this, it morphed into this thing. It's very meta. It's like, it's a show within a show. It's happening in front of you. We're very aware of what we're doing. And it's basically these two guys that are trying to put on this Star Wars show that they wrote together, because they tried to do it at Comic-Con, but they got banned from Comic-Con for an incident that happened. And so now they're here off Broadway, and they needed a girl for the show. And this girl who just graduated from college, you know, just got in the show, and she has her own agenda, because we kind of had to write like, what's going on? We can't just do sketches for an hour and be like, is there a story? Like, what the hell's happening? We wanted it to be engaging. And so we created this loose storyline that got stronger and stronger, where basically it was like, we need to figure out a reason why she hates Star Wars. We love it. We have to teach her. Like, she's almost like the audience experience, like over the next hour and 15 minutes, like we need to teach her why Star Wars are the greatest thing that ever happened in the galaxy, much, much better than Star Trek. And we're like, that should be the title of the show. And so that became the title. We made it so literal. It was called A Musical About Star Wars, or Why Star Wars is the Greatest Thing That Ever Happened in the Galaxy. Much, much. That's on all the posters.
Right.
So it just became this thing, and but we just kept working at it.
For a second, though, how many guys do you know who've had that conversation with a girlfriend? I mean, I've heard women or young women like make fun of their boyfriends about how nerdy they were about Star Wars, and how they
These
long conversations where the guy would try to convince them how awesome it was, and they just weren't into it. You know?
Oh, totally.
So yeah, it's very universal sort of aspect of fandom, you know?
Yeah. And what was great about it was, you know, it's like we kind of wrote caricature versions of ourselves, and the role of Emily was basically based on Tom, you know, being this like political driven, because he's been in politics for years, and, you know, he's campaigned for Hillary Clinton on every race she's been in, you know, things like that. So like that became the driving force for that character. And like politically, like her whole thing is like Star Wars is misogynistic and sexist. And you know that there's only three female characters with lines besides Princess Leia. And this like true thing that we would look up and find, you know, to balance it. And then they come together at the end, because, you know, Star Wars is progressive, and they have made these changes, and just like our society is progressive. And like, so we made it, there is a little bit of like where we are in the world now, which I think you don't expect, because it is so stupid, over the top, you know, absurd humor, and we're very aware, but also there is a cool message at the end of the day. Like the, one of the songs we sing at the end is called Be the Change That You Wish to Be in the Galaxy. And it's full of jokes, but like, it's a cool song and it's a cool message. And I think that's what's been so cool about the show is, you know, we did it very unconventionally. Like, I know a lot of people who work on their shows for years, they keep having readings, but like Tom knew that we were closing Newsical last year in the summer. And this was literally a year ago from right now was when we were first in preview performances. And he was like, here's the thing. We have this theater space, and we have like four nights a week. We can do this right now and just try it. Like, let's just try it. So we did a quick reading. The reading was so long and awful, but we found out what to cut and what to do. And we put it on its feet and heard what got laughs, what didn't. And again, going back to what I was talking about my partner Jamie earlier, I was like I try every joke on her, and she's brutally honest with me, and I love her and hate her for it. But it's like, for her, she had heard every incarnation of the show at that point. And when she finally came and saw like the most finished product of like when we had cut most stuff, and it was a really good house. And afterwards she was like, it's really funny. It's really fun. And she's someone who doesn't care for Star Wars. She knows, but she doesn't really care for it. She's not like a huge fan, but she loves theater, and we have plenty of theater jokes in there, and stuff like that too. And so to get that kind of feedback, I was like, oh shit, this works. Like, this is cool. Like, you know, like, and that's the thing. It might not be everyone's cup of tea. It is very like, this would be like, if this were a film, it would definitely be like some cult classic indie film. You know, that's why we're off Broadway, and we're very aware of that and stuff. But like, we literally perform in a church basement theater, which is perfect for the show. And it's called St. Luke's, which is hilarious that it's called that. We reference that, you know? But that's, it's what's also been really cool about it too is, and I have to put things in perspective for myself, and anyone should do this. Anyone should take a time and whatever it is they do, because we can all get so discouraged about the world, about ourselves, about like not getting that promotion, like whatever happens to you in your life. It's so easy to beat ourselves up, and I do it constantly. I'm aware, and I'm always working on it. But like, we have had people in the last several months who keep coming back to the show. We literally have a few, and we might not have a lot, but we have a few, like a musical about Star Wars diehard fans, and they'll sit in the front row. They'll dress up, I kid you not, and whatever their Star Wars. One girl, she makes like Star Wars, like Lego lightsaber earrings and stuff. And she's like sells them on Etsy, and she loves the show and has the album, and she comes constantly, and she sits in the front and sings along. Like, that's cool. And like, we had a show on Valentine's Day, before we closed, like Broadway and everything else closed recently. But I thought, because in my history of doing shows, especially like offbeat comedies like this off Broadway, like I was like Valentine's Day, like people are going to go spend money on a Broadway show for a date. They're not going to come here. Dude, we were full, sold out on Valentine's Day. So when we went out, and it was like as if we had like a laugh track or like an applause sign, like they were eating up that night. It was amazing, an amazing experience, an amazing show. And I had the thought afterwards that was very cool and very humbling. I was like, these people are going to remember tonight. Like, it's Valentine's Day. Like, you go out and you want to make you want to make that night special for someone. So like, these people chose to come here to our show tonight because they share a bond over this shared experience of Star Wars. They heard about this show. They probably went and had dinner, and they wanted to have this shared experience with everyone tonight. And it was an awesome experience. And now they will have that. And so, for me, that was one of the first times that kind of hit me of, no, like, we might not be selling out constantly. We might not be like making a shit ton of money or this or that, but the fact that we have these, even these few people that love this show, come and sing along, come back, laughed, like tell us after the show, like sometimes they wait around and we're like, that was so much fun. Like, I've never seen anything like this. Or like, you know, I've never seen someone, you know, relate to me in that way of like, I am that character, you know. That's cool.
Well, and you're making people's lives better.
Yeah.
That's what's happening in that moment. And this ties into one of the main reasons why I wanted to do a podcast like this, is because I guess I've been through enough in life to know and to see that when we're doing what we're really meant to do, it has the power to make the world a better place.
It's true.
And you are clearly doing with your life what, I mean, you are Taylor. There's nothing else that you could do, really. I mean, it just wouldn't add up in my mind if you did anything other than, you know, based on what I've seen and what I know, and just haven't had the opportunity to talk to you. And it's obvious this is what you're supposed to be doing. Totally. And you're thriving and enhancing people's lives. It's awesome.
No, it's very cool. And it's funny because, like I said, even it's so funny how easily we can get in our own way. Like that quote I was saying, like, you're the only one who can kind of stop yourself. But it's like, that's also something I've struggled with. And I think that's part of this learning process I'm in right now, of like, even just having this conversation with you right now, is how I've always been like, I'm always like, I don't want to brag, or like, oh, I don't want to post these pictures because I don't want to, like, you know, like, I don't like to, like I put myself out there and I perform and stuff like that. But I know a lot of people, there's a lot of performers who are like, tag me on this, like social media, this, like, you know, like things like that. Right. But I'm like, oh God, you know, and I don't want to be like that. And that's something I have struggled with since I was a kid, was comparing myself. And that's one thing I struggle with constantly, whether it's like, this is the one thing that you can't do. And I'm better, but like, I'd be like, God damn it. When Bill Hader was 29, he was already doing this. Like, dude, shut up. Don't say that. Right. Like that's a no-no. Like, don't, or also, you know, like, don't sit there and say like, oh, I'm not going to post this video because I don't want to look like, you know, Joe Schmo who made this really bad video. And like, but that's not you. Like, don't compare yourself either way. Just do what you do and keep having fun and being creative with it. And things will happen. And I've noticed, because in the last couple of years, something did happen that did stifle that. And I haven't fully recovered from it. Like, I've been doing things, but it's like, that's something I'm still struggling with. And that's part of my path to authenticity that I'm learning constantly, is like, how do we get past those mental hurdles that we create for ourselves? You know, like, you would sit here and even just talking to you, and like, everything that I have said that I've done in the short amount of time or accomplished, like, I will still sometimes put a hurdle up in front of myself for no reason.
I think one of the other things we do that I find myself doing, I always look at what I haven't done.
Yeah. Oh, that's been me lately a lot.
Yeah. And we have to be sometimes intentional about, like, cut that out. Like, think of all the things you have done.
Right. And how is that helpful at this point? Unless you're actively doing something about it, then you're not sitting there. Like, if I'm just sitting there saying, like, God, I really need to be doing stand-up. One of these days, I'm not doing it anymore. Then go fucking do it. Like, you sit there and you keep talking about, like, should have done that 5 years ago. Like, oh, I should have picked up the banjo again. Like, then you should have done it. Like, just stop thinking about it. And I'm so good at, like, putting it in print, but it's the act of doing it. You know, exercise for me has been a really great gift and tool in teaching me those kinds of attainable goal skills. Like, I played sports growing up, but it wasn't until, like, I was in New York that I really started exercising a lot more for my physical and mental health. And it is part of this profession of, like, yeah, I got hired to be Gaston because, you know, I had put on some weight and gotten a little bigger, you know, at the time. And there's part of that aesthetic, that visual aesthetic, obviously, with performing. But there's a really cool thing with exercise. That's very cool because it's a visual goal along with a feeling, like, because of the endorphins you release when you exercise, and you immediately will feel good. Or you might not feel great, but like, you'll feel better. Like, if you haven't run in so long, you're like, oh my God, my chest. And like, but these endorphins are still released, and you're like, God, I'm glad I did that. Like, why have I been putting that off? Or to make goals for yourself of like, hey, I want to bench press this or that, or like, you will physically, if you put in the work, and I will still go to the gym on days when I'm like, or like, even during this quarantine, I'm like, I don't want to do anything today. Like, I just want to watch TV. I was like, I'm going to go do like 50 pushups, right? Like, in between commercials or whatever. Just do it. Like, just do it. I make myself go do that. I'm always glad I did it afterwards. And when you put in the time for something, even when you don't want to do it, you will see the results. Mm-hmm. And I've translated that for a lot of things of like, that's within, Taylor, you need to go to open mics like you do go to the gym. Like, there are days when you don't want to go do an open mic, or you don't want to go to the gym, but you still go in. You got to put in the work. And I think then 6 months later, when you see that, like, hey, my stage presence has gotten a lot better when I tell this joke, or hey, like, I actually have some abs when I look in the mirror, like, you see it, you feel it. So that for me, especially while during this self quarantine, I've been really trying to focus on that, of not like being like, you have to do this, like, you know, like this pressure, but of just, exercise is important, you know, being mentally creative is important, you know, don't judge yourself, just do the things you want to do. It's like, don't, you know, you don't need to beat yourself up about
so
it.
So that about what this kind of ties into how I try to close these episodes with, you know, yeah. if there was a time in your life when you most needed to hear something like this, when was it and what was it?
I don't know like the exact day, moment, time, but when I was a teenager, I would go back and I would tell myself, I would like, and if I didn't listen, I would then shake my kid version self to listen to me. But I'd be like, don't care about what people think. I used to get so wrapped up in that, and it's translated into my adult life to where that is the hurdle. That's the hurdle I've been talking to you about, of where like when I was even a kid, I would be like, oh, but I don't, when I want to do that joke in front of my grandparents, or would this person think I'm funny, or would this, like, and that's such a hard thing when you're 13, 14 years old and you're going through puberty and you're going from middle school to high school and there is popular, like all of that stuff. It's like, that's part of being a teenager and growing up, and it's awkward. But I was like really allowing that to go into what I like to do. And I know you're constantly being judged, but like, if I could just stress that more to the younger version of myself, to not care what other people think about who you are, about your truth, about what it is that you do, I think that would help me a lot.
Yeah.
I would appreciate that too, because there's been, you know, it's been, yeah.
You know,
that's what I would say. Yeah.
I'm not the easiest guy to make laugh. You know, I mean, I'm someone who sometimes I criticize myself for not laughing out loud enough, but I swear to you, you know, even as I'm sitting here listening to you, I'm thinking of, you know, when you mentioned what I want my grandparents to hear this joke or whatever.
Yeah.
There was a song that I heard you sing in front of your grandmother that I still, you know what song I'm talking about?
No.
The butt sex song.
Oh, I did that in front of her?
You did.
Oh my God. Yeah, like it was like an R&B. It was very like Andy Samberg, but it was like oh God, yeah, that song it was like, oh, butt sex is the only thing on my mind. Yeah, I sang that in front of her. I can't believe
did.
I did that.
You did.
That's funny. That's a funny situation.
Yeah. That was, but you know, I mean, it just goes to show you've had the right kind of support.
You know, absolutely.
You've been accepted always.
Yeah.
So, and that's a gift. Like not everybody, it's not always safe for us to be who we are. Not for everybody.
No.
And what I do day to day, dealing with a lot of young guys who, have addiction issues.
Yeah.
A lot of times that's a big part of it. Like, you know, they kind of teach themselves to protect themselves by not really being who they are. And then you get way off course in life, and you know, the healing is always the path back to yourself, you know,
absolutely,
which is another 100%. Reason why I wanted to, you know, to have this be about that, because it's a issue that everyone deals with on some level.
Oh, I know. That's something I've learned from you. I've learned from my dad. You know, it's yeah.
Yeah.
It's very real.
Well, you know, this has been great. And, you know, part of me is tempted to ask you to like take us out with maybe a couple impressions or something, like your favorites. What are your favorites?
My favorite ones.
Say goodbye. And,
I mean, sometimes you always got to bring George W. back, because, I mean, folks, I know we're in crazy times, but I just got to say, how do you like me now? Okay, folks, I'm serious. How y'all like me now, huh? I mean, it's getting pretty crazy out there. And I got to tell you, folks, you know, things are getting pretty crazy in Europe, but did you know this? Did you know the French, they don't even have a word for entrepreneur? It's crazy. I don't know if that's crazy. I don't know. I always like that one. Like I said, we can go back. I would gladly hear a George W. Bush impression. No one wants to hear a Trump impression all the time anymore. Yeah. Like, let's bring Bill. I would love to hear what Bill has to say about this pandemic. You know, it's like, bring them all back.
Right.
Yeah, I think actually, Tom, I think the best voice to sign off on, because he's easy and he's breezy, and I think Matthew McConaughey is the best way that we should end this whole experience, Tom, because when you think about it, it's mind-blowing that you could be taking a walk in the woods, and you're looking up, and you see a little leaf, and it's just blowing in the wind. Blowing, and saying a little whisper to you, a little song. It says, hey, man, this is the path to authenticity. Then you beat your chest a little bit, and you walk on out of that forest a new man. It's beautiful. It's a beautiful ending to a beautiful podcast. All right.
Thanks for listening to The Path to Authenticity. If you'd like to learn more about our guest, you can find links in the show notes or visit our website at thepathtoauthenticity.com. If you're interested in becoming a sponsor, if you have a suggestion for a topic, or you know someone who would make a great guest, email the show at thepathtoauthenticity@gmail.com. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave a review on Apple Podcasts. If you know someone else who would enjoy the show, or even just a particular episode, please share it with them. Every little bit helps. If you're not already a subscriber, please consider becoming one wherever it is you choose to listen. You can find the show on Patreon, where by becoming a patron, you can hear episodes before they're released publicly. You can gain access to supplemental content. There are other benefits in the various tiers. Visit patreon.com/thepathtoauthenticity. Join our Facebook community or follow the show on Instagram, both at The Path to Authenticity. We also have a YouTube channel. You can connect with us on Twitter or Pinterest. To hear the songs from this and every episode, you can find the Path to Authenticity playlist on Spotify. Obviously, there are a lot of ways you could be spending your time, so I appreciate you spending some of it here with me. I'm Tom Gentry. Thanks for listening. Be nice.
The Path to Authenticity is powered by Equivox. For digital marketing and web design services, visit Equivox.com.
All right. All right. One more. Do Rodney Force.
Okay. What up, podcast world? Rodney Force here, filling in for Taylor Crowstore. Guess what, motherfuckers? This is the goddamn motherfucking path to motherfucking authenticity. There you go.